I believe that we in the church, I thought I'd start with a bold statement. We in the church, indeed in any religious or spiritual institution, are so used to weird that we don't notice it anymore. Maybe I'm just stating the obvious, but so much of what we're used to, the sitting and standing, which I have often referred to as Anglican aerobics that we seem to do all the way through any service, the oldie English of our prayer books, someone reading to us from a book in public, even singing together in public and listening to choristers sing, is not really in most people's everyday experience. And that weirdness increases exponentially when we open our Bibles. Yes, I've said it, the Bible is weird. Or to be fair, there are some bits of the Bible that are very strange indeed. And even stranger are the ways that people choose to interpret it. Take, for instance, the first two chapters of the book of Genesis. Chapter 1 into chapter 2, verse 3, is a hymn. It's about creation. It has repeated turns of phrase. It follows a certain shape and pattern. It's quite definitely not an attempt at a scientific treatise explaining the beginning of the universe. Then, from verse 4 of Genesis chapter 2, we have a different creation account in a different order with a very different feel. It, too, is not trying to be an account of the beginning of the world. It is a story. And yet, much ink, and indeed blood, has been spilled by literalists who do not look at these accounts and see the strangeness of them. The poetry, the fantastical nature of the stories. Instead, they try and reconcile the real world around us with these ancient stories and poems as if they offer somehow an actual on-the-ground historical account of the beginnings of the universe, without taking any account of the weird at all. I mean, if we were to just stop and say, that's weird, these stories say different things, they seem to be poetic, they don't seem to be scientific, then a whole load of trouble would have been saved. But that's just my personal thesis. Which leads me on to Ezekiel. In fact, it could lead me on to either of the readings for this evening. Because the whole thing about, I saw you under a fig tree, oh, you are the Messiah, in response, and the angels ascending and descending up and down on the Son of Man, merits a sermon on its own with regards to weirdness. But I know, firstly, that I've preached on that before, and two, I really wanted to dig a little bit into Ezekiel. Ezekiel is full of weird. There are visions, there are wheels within wheels, there are eyeballs all over the place. There are strange actions that the prophet is called to do, like lying on one side for 6 months in the marketplace and then turning over for another 6 months, or shaving half of his hair off. Ezekiel is a strange and singular prophet, but weird is kind of the point. The author wants to take us out of our everyday and wants us to take note of what the prophet is really addressing, that Israel has become a nation of injustice, which ignores the way of God, the way of love. It is said repeatedly in a strange way. We are told in today's verses that we heard that the people may well not listen, verse 5, and yet they will know that, quote, there has been a prophet among them, unquote. They may not listen, but they will know that truth has been spoken, and that even with a literally thorny and briar-filled reception, Ezekiel should continue to speak divine truth. Then Ezekiel is given a scroll covered on top and bottom in lamentations and woes, or in the original Hebrew, I think it's more like dirges. And he is told to eat it, and he does so. As the passage says, it tastes like honey in his mouth. Weird. And even weirder when you consider that a biblical scholar of the weight of Robert Alter considers that this might have its roots in real events, that the scroll could only have had writing on both sides if it were papyrus, not the animal skin parchment that was common in those days, and such a piece of papyrus would indeed be edible. The taste of honey and the being filled are, I believe, metaphorical. They are a reminder that the truth, no matter how hard it may be to receive, is ultimately more nourishing than lies, and that truth fills us when we internalize it in a good way, whereas falsehood leaves us wanting. Could the writers have said it another way? Yes, they could. But the fact that 25 or 30 centuries later, we are still wrestling with it, we are still working out and considering what this means, shows that the weirdness has an impact. We are called to truth, to hearing, receiving, internalizing, speaking, and living out truth, no matter how hard it may be. Because in the end, it will only be truth that truly satisfies. In this era where truth-telling is at a premium, and it is hard to speak truth in the face of a tsunami of lies from those who would have us in conflict with one another and seek to exclude those who do not fit a certain mold, in such an era, it is even more important that we are the weird ones, the ones who in poetry and art and music and prose, whichever ways, are attending to and standing for truth, and who are seeking to change the world through truth-telling and through living the values of faith, hope, and above all, love. Thanks be to God. Amen.